The second case for oral argument this morning is Pamela McDowell Appellant versus Citibank and Planet Insurance Appellees. For the appellant is Mr. Brian Radke, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellees is Ms. Christy Eisler-Holm, an attorney from Sioux Falls also. Mr. Radke, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. Good morning. I'd like to start out by giving a very brief overview of the history of this case. In 1996, the claimant settled a permanent total disability claim by entering into a written compromise settlement agreement with the employer and insurer. In 2000, about 4 years later, the claimant filed a petition to reopen, seeking to reopen the compromise agreement, seeking to reopen based upon a substantial change in medical and mental condition under 62.733. In 2003, a hearing was held on claimant's reopening petition. The hearing examiner, in effect, allowed a complete litigation with respect to the issue of employability resulting from claimant's work-related injury. The department, in effect, ignored the language of the compromise agreement and ruled claimant was unemployable at the time of the settlement in 1996. Claimant's petition to reopen was denied. The department further ruled that in order to reopen under 62.733, claimant had to establish not just a substantial change in her medical condition resulting from her work-related injury, but that she also had to show that the change in medical condition and psychological condition led to a change in earning capacity. Because Judge Binger concluded the claimant was already permanently, totally disabled and unemployable at the time of settlement, he surmised it would be impossible to prove claimant to prove a substantial change in earning capacity. The theory being, if she was unemployed in 96, she's can't be more unemployable in the year 2000.
Well, maybe it's overly simplistic, but are there degrees of total disability, or is it like death? Either you are or you aren't.
Well, you either are or you aren't.
Okay, and that's what the hearing officer said, right, when he denied your petition to reopen?
Absolutely, that's it. Okay. That's exactly what he said.
Why is he wrong?
Well, it's kind of a twofold reason. The first reason is that based upon the language of SOPCO and other reopening cases, the settlement agreement, as long as the language of the agreement is unambiguous, any term or any issues addressed that are unambiguously addressed by the terms of the settlement agreement or the compromise agreement in this case are binding. They speak for themselves. This court has adopted several rules, there's been several cases interpreting compromise agreements as they relate to reopening petitions. Professor Larson has argued in the past that a compromise settlement agreement, a written one, should be akin to a findings of fact and conclusions of law issued by a law judge after a full hearing. And the reason I believe that Judge Binger is wrong in this case is because with respect to the issue of employability, whether or not she could ever work again, that issue was more than thoroughly addressed in the terms of the compromise agreement. And if I guess
you're saying that anything not specifically addressed in the compromise agreement would be fair game for reopening at a later date should the condition change.
Anything not addressed?
Yes.
I would say, you know, it's an evolving area of the law, Judge. There's only been so many rulings, SOPCO being probably the prominent one, as to how we're going to interpret this whole principle of the settlement agreement speaks for itself. In SOPCO, this court ruled basically that because there was no language in the agreement specifically saying a particular condition, in that case a seizure condition resulting from brain injury, there's no specific thing in, no specific comment in the settlement agreement which said that the injury was non-compensable. It only said that there was no permanent disability associated with that condition. This court ruled that there was no specific limiting statement made about the seizure condition. Therefore, reopening was not precluded based upon that particular change in condition. That's just one example. But in this particular case, I think it's probably unusual, but maybe not that unusual, that parties to a settlement agreement, parties to a workers' compensation case, could look at all the factors and come to a conclusion that they're willing to enter into what is a compromise agreement, an agreement that doesn't give the claimant everything that she's requested in her petition. And it's not unforeseeable whatsoever that when you have a compromise and the claimant doesn't get everything she's requested, that somebody was wrong. The claimant either blinked too early, and as the hearing examiner alleges in this case, could have gone on and could have won a permanent total disability settlement and left that money on the table, or in the alternative, the employer insurer might have guessed wrong, and they should have held out, gone to trial, and they could have got out of this without $32,000 in new benefits and $8,000 in medicals. There's always somebody wrong.
Aren't you suggesting in this case that this claimant basically guessed wrong at the time of the settlement? Because really, she was more disabled than what the employer claimed, yet she settled anyway. And so now you're just asking to get what she gave up the first time. That's really what's happening here, isn't it?
Justice Zinner, that what you said there is true, but the law, I don't think, allows, I mean, I respectfully say this, the court sure to consider that conclusion in that manner.
Well, let me ask it another way then. As I understand the record, this claimant testified that she was totally disabled at the time of the settlement. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's no doubt she felt from the time she filed the petition in 1993 that she was totally disabled.
So if she was totally, if she believed that the nature of her condition was total disability at the time she signed the settlement, what change has occurred? Because she claims she's totally disabled today. What change has happened? What's the change?
So your change in medical condition, I think, is well chronicled and well documented, medical and psychological condition. I mean, I went through a very detailed litany of all the change that's occurred in the brief. I think what you're probably focusing more on, if I might take the liberty, is what change in employability has taken place. I think
disability. We're here to treat somebody's disability,
and
to make compensation for their disability. And as I read this record, her disability, as she claimed it then, and as she claims it today, is no different.
I don't think that's...
Is that correct?
No, I don't think so. I think her employability may not have changed, but her disability, her inability to do certain physical tasks which could affect employability, her ability to do any job, even if it's a job for 2 hours a week, that has diminished. Her psychological condition has deteriorated based upon her medical condition. Her medical condition itself has deteriorated. Her condition and symptoms, not just her perception of pain, but her numbness, her swelling, all those things have increased and made her less and less able to do things, and therefore, by definition, more and more disabled. I mean, I can be unemployable and still get worse. I can go from being unable to find any job or do any type of gainful 40-hour week employment, and later on, because of cancer, because of whatever the physical malady might be, or maybe schizophrenia, I might get to the point where I can do even less than I could before. And technically, in answer to your question, That's an increased disability. And it might not affect employability, but it is an increased disability. And we are here to talk about increased disability.
Right, but before we do that, we have to determine what the condition was at the time of settlement, don't we? You don't start talking about increase until you determine where you were at in the beginning, right?
Justice Sabres, that's absolutely correct.
All right, and if somebody claims, the employer claims zero, their position is zero, no disability whatsoever, or 5%, say like Hoverson said, and the claimant claims 100%, but you reach a compromise settlement, then obviously it's somewhere in between, isn't it? And let's say you settle at 3, okay?
Okay.
On a scale of 0 to 10.
Right.
You settle at 3. Well, then the hearing officer's got to go back and look not at what the claims of the claimant is, and not necessarily at the claims of 0 of the insurer, but what the real condition was. What was her condition at the time of settlement, right?
I totally disagree with that, if I can explain, but it's okay.
You can in a minute.
Okay.
And I'm saying that's what you look at in order to determine whether or not there's any increase or decrease in her condition. Now, go ahead and explain yourself.
Well, you definitely would have to. What I said earlier was that if the compromise agreement specifically addresses a given issue, whether it's a medical condition, whether it's compensability, such as was the issue in the Sopko case, or whether it's employability, as long as it's specific and it's unambiguous, that's the law of the case, is my point.
And in this compromise settlement, how can it be unambiguous? I mean, how can it be unambiguous? One side's arguing one thing, one side's arguing the other. It's got to be somewhere in between, but where is it unless you look at the conditions of the claimant?
Well, for instance, if the two parties were to have come to an agreement and respondent's counsel who drafted this particular agreement put in there, the parties agree claimant is permanently totally disabled. Not claimant thinks she is, claimant presumes she is, claimant says she is, but the parties agree claimant is permanently totally disabled, and that this is a compromise agreement for all future benefits reduced to present value, and that she'll never get another dime. That is what's called, without a doubt, an unequivocal, unambiguous finding that would bind this court and would forever make this issue res judicata.
Right, but we don't have that here.
No,
do we?
We don't.
All
right. Instead, we've got...
What do we have here?
Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's all right.
All right.
I'm asking you.
I know, but I don't mean to interrupt. What we've got here is a settlement agreement which, Justice Sabres, does not thoroughly address the medical condition. Basically, the medical condition, it says she's got an upper extremity condition resulting from a work-related injury, and that's about it. So I'm not arguing, and I know the Kaczynski case is hanging out there, which is also my case, where it sounds like I could say, well, you know what, you've got to look at the medical condition. You can only garner it from the settlement agreement. That's only true if they spell it out to the nth degree, such that this person would expect that her condition at the time of settlement was this forever. That wasn't done. But with respect to employability, it was done. The agreement said upper extremity injury. The agreement said that if claimant were to go to hearing, she would not get substantially more benefits than the $32,000 in new benefits, which is 2 years worth of benefits. In other words, she wouldn't win. That's a definite statement. On top of that, counsel for respondents added, which counsel today was not counsel at that time, and I was not the claimant's counsel at that time, but counsel for respondents at the time also included Dr. Hoverston's and Dr. Easton's IME reports and incorporated them by reference into the body of the agreement. Dr. Hoverson's report, which was used basically to get a settlement in the first place, I would argue, said go back to work, maximum medical improvement, go back to your original line of employment, and it also said that there is no impairment necessary for the condition of reflex sympathetic dystrophy. Now, does that fly in the face of everything you, the justices here have said this morning with respect to my client and what she thought her condition was? And maybe what her doctors thought her condition was. Maybe the point to be proven is that you can get a doctor to say anything. I don't know. Maybe that's the point that needs to be made. But when you incorporate that opinion into the body of the compromise agreement, and it's a medical opinion which says go back to work, no disability, no impairment due to RSD, which flies in the face of everything claimant believes, well then, Judge Justice Sabres, I believe that this court should conclude that under the cases saying that the settlement agreement speaks for itself, that this is one of those instances and this is one of those issues where the agreement that was bargained for between the parties, in other words, contract principles which have been applied by this court to the interpretation of settlement agreement, the bargain for agreement was $32,000 in new benefits, and that absolutely befits the other terms and the other language in the agreement. Why shouldn't, here's my question, why shouldn't a claimant who is afraid to take a chance at hearing and who hears opinions from a Sioux Falls doctor saying go back to work, there's nothing wrong with you, even though they think they'll never work again, why shouldn't they be allowed to settle so long as the settlement agreement with respect to the issue of employability clearly reflects, first of all, they're not perm total, but more importantly, and this is something I'd ask that you consider, there is a paragraph thrown in there that says she can reopen. Now, although we've heard argument throughout this brief, throughout the briefs and stuff, the claimant was permanently totally disabled and that they settled this case based upon her assertions alone without doing any type of vocational investigation, although we've heard all that, the fact is that settlement agreement indicates anything but that. They don't believe it. You know, I guess I don't know where I'm going with this, but the fact is this agreement stands for itself and with employability. She may have guessed wrong, and that's the point I was going to make. Imagine a settlement agreement where somebody doesn't get everything they ask for. Somebody's always wrong. I guess I did make that point. Somebody's always going to be wrong. And when they think that they can reopen, that's what I was going to say, because they got that put in there. What good is a reopening provision if the parties contemplate she's already permanently totally disabled? It means nothing.
Well, that brings up an interesting point. And I almost hate to say this, but, you know, this case looks to me like she made a bad settlement originally for whatever reason. And now she's coming back and trying to fix it when she was totally disabled at both times. I mean, is that kind of what happened here?
You know, I'll leave that up to the members of this court to determine. What I will say is that under the laws in existence at the time the settlement agreement was entered into, it seems clear that her lawyer made sure there were things in the agreement which made it possible to reopen in the future and which indicated that protect her in case she guessed wrong. And that was basically the law at the time. And, you know, we can go on forever about whether or not somebody guessed wrong, whether they got bad legal advice, whatever they got. And, you know.
Let me ask it this way then. Do you really think the statute was passed to allow people to reopen who guess wrong when they settle their case?
Yeah, I do. I do, because I think that the legislature, as opposed to lawyers and judicial people, I think that they contemplated that they just wanted to see the injured worker get a chance to get the benefits they were entitled to. It's no bargain settling, even with this agreement saying she wasn't unemployable. There's no bargain settling under those terms for $32,000 and having the only possibility be that you go try to reopen and show a substantial change in medical condition. You don't just reopen tomorrow. She has to show a substantial change in medical condition. And I think that the legislature contemplated that in reality, if somebody showed that their change had gotten much worse and the agreement said they hadn't been paid anything close to the level of damages or benefits they'd be entitled to today, That's exactly what they would have wanted. The statutes should be liberally construed to effectuate the purpose of the act. And the purpose of the act is to take care of the injured worker. It's not an adversarial proceeding. It's trying to make sure they get what they're entitled to. And in the same respect, should attorneys be able to hire experts and get them to say preposterous things that drive people who are going through mental and emotional pain and struggling in a workers' compensation case, such as she was here, which is well chronicled, and get them to say whatever they pay them to say, to the extent that this ridiculous opinion is the opinion of the case, it cuts off her benefits and tells her to go back to work. And now the court, for understandable reasons, is posing the question to me as her counsel today, well, did you settle too cheap? And at the same time, it was the system which allowed that type of a IME report to take place and to be inserted into this opinion, which may be to blame more than my client's judgment, given the fact and the well-documented history of her mental and emotional pain and suffering going on as a result of this injury, which Horson claimed never happened.
Your time has expired, Mr. Radke. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Gisler-Holm, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, good morning. The issue presented today really is not as complicated as what appellant would lead the court to believe, both in the argument and in the briefs that have been submitted. The sole issue that was decided by the Department of Labor and the only issue before this court today is whether appellant is entitled to any additional benefits when she has had no change in her earning capacity. She had the burden and was required to prove that her earning capacity had changed between the time the case was settled in 1996 and the time she sought to reopen the claim.
Are you conceding then that if she could have shown that under the agreement it was legally possible to reopen it?
I'm saying that the Department of Labor on motions for summary judgment ruled that the agreement itself in this case did not preclude the ability to attempt to reopen under 62733, and that issue was not appealed. That does not mean, however, that just because you can petition to reopen, that you have proven your case and are entitled to reopen.
So we're looking at a factual question, not a legal question. We're looking at her condition, not whether the document allows us to reopen to begin with.
I think given the posture of the case, that's exactly what you're looking at in this case, because that issue was addressed early on before the Department of Labor. Appeals were not filed on that specific issue. So we are looking factually at, and I think your honors have hit it on the head in the prior questions, what was her condition at the time of the 1996 settlement?
Right.
What was it later? That's exactly what you need
and
to look
what
at.
Was, and you don't look solely at Dr. Hoverson's record or Dr. Hoverson's report, do you?
Absolutely.
I mean, you don't take the best argument your side submitted and say you're bound by that, that she only has, that she can go back to work. So you were really saying back then, or you submitted a report that said she was she's employable, she can earn 100%. But you're not bound by that in the sense of what her condition was, are you?
No, I think that's exactly correct. You know, the case back in between 1993 and 1996, when the petition for hearing was pending, all parties were doing their job. They were getting IME reports. They were seeking vocational opinions. The case just, frankly, had not progressed that far when claimant's attorney approached counsel for an employer and insurer to settle the claim.
And then by the same token, it's improper to look at her claims of total disability to permanently establish what her condition is, isn't it? You don't look at Hoverson's report and you don't look at her claims to determine, oh, well, she was totally unemployable at that time, and now you can't ever improve on that.
I think if I understand your question correctly, that's correct. You don't look at just simply her legal claims in her pleadings that are filed. That's certainly something to consider, that in the petition for hearing, her answers to interrogatories, even the settlement, they all reflect that she was claiming to be totally disabled.
Right.
But what's most telling is her actual actions, her statements to Social Security, her actual conduct, the fact that she had not worked.
Don't you look at her actual condition you determine as best you can what her condition was then and whether or not it's improved or deep or gotten worse.
Exactly. And I don't think you can single out just one medical record like appellant would like to do with Dr. Hoberston's report. She saw many, many doctors, and there's one doctor in that bunch that said she was employable. You know, what appellant, I think, would like this court to believe is that had this case gone to hearing, despite her testimony, despite her actions, despite all of the other medical opinions, there is no doubt at all that the Department of Labor would have believed Dr. Hoberston out of all of that evidence, and she would not have prevailed. We don't know that. The case never went that far. The parties disputed the issues. A settlement was reached. Both parties were represented by attorneys. It was an arm's-length transaction. I mean, with regard to the settlement itself, I feel like I need to point out that it's not that she received $32,000. The settlement was actually for nearly $45,000 plus an $8,000 waiver of long-term disability benefits. So she did receive over $50,000. Counsel for appellant also emphasizes that Dr. Hoberston's opinion was incorporated there. What his opinion did was in paragraph 3 of that agreement, it indicated there was a dispute as to the impairment ratings assigned. Dr. Hoberston assigned a 5% rating. Dr. Shutt assigned a 45% rating. Both of those reports were attached. That's standard practice before the Department of Labor, simply to document that there are two ratings out there, there is a dispute, we're compromising this case. There is no statement in this agreement that says claimant was employable in 1996. If there was, we wouldn't be here today. If there was a statement that said she was not employable, we wouldn't be here.
I think that brings up the crucial point. Does it really matter what the agreement says? I mean, isn't it more important to look at the testimony at the hearing and the motion to reopen to establish whether the testimony indicates that whatever her condition was in 95 has changed until 2003? And what the doctors may... What you may have put in the settlement agreement doesn't matter. It's what the evidence is at the reopening hearing that governs whether her condition has changed.
I think that's correct. I think there are other things that you can be looking at, but in the recent Kazuski decision this court issued, I think whether you look solely at the agreement was specifically addressed by the court there, and you found that, no, you don't look at just the agreement. You look at what the claimant's condition was, and the court specifically recognized that pre-settlement and post-settlement medical records, vocational records, and I believe particularly in this case, claimant's own testimony is exactly what the court needs to look at so that they can have a basis for comparison. You want to be able to look at what she was like then, what she was like at the hearing, and her testimony is the most critical, I think, in that, because her own statements were that she was in severe, chronic, and debilitating pain that prevented her from working in 1995 when she applied for Social Security benefits, in 1996 when she settled the claim, in 1998 when she petitioned to, or when she had to requalify for Social Security disability benefits, in 2000 when she filed the petition for hearing, and in 2003 when she actually testified at the workers' compensation hearing. Basically, for 10 years, she has maintained the position that she is disabled from employment. She has not worked since 1994. She has not looked for work since 1994. At all times, by her own testimony, she has viewed herself to be disabled from employment. That has never changed. And because she cannot show a change in her employability or her disability, she is not entitled to reopen and seek additional benefits.
But that brings up the other question. When we talk about change of condition, does change of condition mean the medical condition, or does it mean the disabling character of the medical impairment? What does the word condition mean in the statute?
I think under the statute and the cases that have interpreted it, it's actually both. You know, in Kazuski, this court spelled out, and since Kazuski, I've struggled with some of the trying to reconcile everything. The court spelled out that there's three elements to establish to make a change in condition. That there is an actual change in condition, that the change is from an unknown injury or unknown disability, and that dates back to the SOPCO decision, and they still need to establish causation. You know, in this case, the department set all of that aside and just assumed that. But the struggle that I have is there's either a fourth step to that analysis that needs to be added, or it's a separate two-step analysis, and those three elements are part of the first step. Because I think that the cases, including the Whitney decision, the Stender decision, and the Stausen decision, all cited in my brief, make it clear that not only must there be a material and substantial change in physical condition, so that's the medical condition, that's the part the department didn't address, but that material and substantial change must also affect earning capacity. That's stated repeatedly in those cases. So to me, there's a two-step analysis. Is there a material and substantial change in physical condition? That's the medical change. And I think that's what the court addressed with the three elements set forth in Kosuski. But then there's a second step that has to be reached, that even if you can reopen by showing a physical change in condition, are you entitled to any additional benefits? And maybe that's then the second prong, that even if you can come and reopen, and that's what the department assumed, we're not going to look at it, we're just going to say, even if she could come back and show she physically changed her condition, can she get any additional benefits anyway when she claims she was totally disabled at the time of settlement and she's totally disabled today? The department concluded she could not, and I believe that decision was correct. Does that answer your question at all?
We'll see.
Stay tuned.
I think, at least as far as what's before the court today, it really is a relatively, I hate to say it's a simple analysis, because I do think it brings in complex legal terms and requires that analysis, but the issue really is quite straightforward. From the questions that you're asking, I think you're seeing that that is the issue. We have to take a look at and see, has this physical condition changed? And if it has it affected her earning capacity? In this case, not only appellant statements, which I've already covered, her direct testimony, but also that of her husband, who confirmed that she was in severe chronic and debilitating pain that prevented her from working from 1994 forward to the time of hearing.
I'm just going to interrupt you, but couldn't this settlement also have been entered into with a thought process of, yes, I'm totally disabled now, but I still have hopes of maybe regaining employability, which would have caused the settlement to be less, which is what your doctors and experts said at the time.
Yeah,
is that the dispute, that she could go back to work at some point? Maybe not at that point, but sometime in the future. Well, now you're saying we're going to take and freeze her in this point, and that's it. We aren't going to be able to, I mean, it didn't turn out that way, but maybe she anticipated it would turn out that way and that she could have gone back to work, and that's why she settled. So why, I guess, how does that fit in?
I mean, I think, and it kind of touches on some of the earlier questions, you're really talking about hindsight. The parties entered into a settlement agreement. Both of them knew, the employer insurer knew, the claimant knew. You could get better, you could get worse. I'm sure there's a number of cases that I've settled in the past where I've paid a significant amount in settlement and the claimant goes out and gets a job the next week and is no longer disabled because their case is done.
Isn't that a change, though, in what you anticipated your employability was going to be? Isn't that a change? At the time she signed the agreement, she thought, yes, I'm totally disabled, but maybe your doctors are right and I'm going to be able to go to work in 2 years. It'll get better. Now it hasn't gotten better. Isn't that a change in employability?
I don't think
she should be allowed to try to prove.
I think she could try to prove that if that were the case. In this case, I don't think that is correct. I mean, that was the gamble she took in entering this settlement, that she knew she had doctors saying she couldn't work. She, in fact, hadn't worked for 2+ years before this settlement was entered. Could she get better? Possibly. I think she testified if she got better, she wouldn't be disabled anymore. If she got worse, she'd still be disabled. The facts of this case are that in 1996, she believed she was disabled from employment. She was not working. She was not looking for work. The same held true in 2003. So could there be a case out there where that type of analysis could come in? Maybe. I don't think that that is what the statute is intended to direct that if you got a, you know, to me, what the appellant is really asserting here is, as it turns out, looking back on it, I got a bad deal. I want more money.
And why that clause in the settlement that allows for reopening?
Actually, that's...
Explain that.
That's a very good question. 62733, if you read the statute, it specifically provides that any payment, including medical payments under 62-4-1 and disability payments under 62-4-3, can be reopened. Her medical expenses remained open. She's still being paid medical expenses. This isn't a case where the settlement agreement shut off everything. So there is the possibility, you know, I don't think we can interpret why the provision was in there. That would be parole evidence. But it's certainly reasonable to assume that because her medical expenses were left open, the possibility is there that she could have a condition develop that she would need to come back under 62733 and reopen to obtain additional medical benefits that otherwise were not covered. And the statute does contemplate both. It's not just disability benefits, even though that's what we tend to see more often. But there are cases, including both SOPCO and the Mills decision, where what the claimant was coming back for initially were additional medical expenses.
So what did she prove at the hearing? I know it's not your position to argue her evidence, but what's the best evidence she put on as far as change of condition?
At the reopening hearing?
At the reopening hearing.
I don't see that she proved anything at the reopening hearing, frankly. The decision was the change in earning capacity. Her testimony, inside and out and upside down, was that she was disabled at all times since 1994. I went through with her a litany of questions that she answered in response to a Social Security application and a personal pain questionnaire in 1995, and specifically went through each aspect of her physical condition, what she could do, what she couldn't do, could she brush her hair, could she do hobbies, could she do activities. And she conceded in her testimony that what she represented in 1995 is exactly how she was in 2003. Some of that may have gotten a little bit worse, but the bottom line was her pain from her upper extremity conditions disabled her from employment back then. It disabled her from employment in 96, and it continued to disable her from employment in 2003. She entered a settlement agreement, and while the settlement agreement itself may not preclude her from coming back to seek the ability to reopen, it does not automatically entitle her to reopen, and she still has to prove the elements under the 62733 statute, which she has not done in this case.
You know, I forgot. I've read it, but I forgot. When was the last time she was able to work at all?
The last time she worked at all, I believe, was in 1994. She had been working part-time employment. In her Social Security application, she represented to them that she had not been gainfully employable since December of 1991. It's my recollection that Social Security awarded benefits retroactive back to 1992. But I don't have the specific month in 1992 that they awarded them back to. And she has continued to receive those benefits since that time, uninterrupted. You know, in addition to the lack of any evidence to show that her physical condition has had an impact on her earning capacity, I think the Department of Labor's decision is correct. Regardless of whether there was any physical change, she showed no effect on this earning capacity, no change in earning capacity. Because of that, the Department of Labor's decision should be affirmed. I would ask that this court affirm that decision. There should be no definite and firm conviction that a mistake was made. The findings of the Department of Labor are clearly supported by the testimony of the claimant, her husband, her vocational expert, her medical providers. They all uniformly testified that as to her employability and her disability. Although it is mentioned in the briefs, due to the time constraints, as far as the physical condition, I just would like to add that we do not believe, even though the Department of Labor did not address the issue, and I don't think it's before this court, and that if anything, it would need to be remanded for that to be decided, we do not believe there has been a change in physical condition The department assumed that without deciding it. We believe the evidence did show that she's unable to prove a physical change in condition or a mental change in condition, if that can even be considered under the terms of the statute, which require a physical change. Appellant has also raised a number of evidentiary issues, and I think those are fully addressed in the briefs. The only thing that I would like to point out is the request to supplement the record with additional reports from Mr. Ostrander. Appellant seeks to introduce that through the statute 126.34. That statute is for the circuit court to consider additional evidence that is material. If there are good reasons, it was not presented to the department. In this case, that evidence was presented to the department. It was rejected by the department. So really, what I believe appellant is seeking to do there is review an evidentiary ruling as they are with the other four issues they've raised. On that particular issue, I think it's clear that the Department of Labor did not abuse its discretion in refusing that evidence. It was only brought to the attention of the Department of Labor not after the first day of testimony in which Mr. Ostrander testified, not in the 2 days of testimony that followed 1 month later. It was not raised in rebuttal. It was not raised after the close of evidence. It was not even raised prior to the time the decision came in. It was only raised after proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law were entered. If it was that important of an issue, it should have been raised before that, and the department did not abuse its discretion. And with that in mind, my time is out, and I would request that you affirm.
You're not quite done yet.
Did Kosiewski, has that caused some confusion with the bar on how to apply this? Does that need some refinement?
For me personally, the only confusion that I have was I think that it analyzes the cases correctly in that you do have to show a material and substantial physical change. That change under SOPCO has to be a new injury or an unknown injury, unknown and, or unanticipated consequence of that. But what I think Kosiewski leaves out is the second factor of the effect on earning capacity, and that's where I think the clarification needs to come in, either as to whether the change in earning capacity is required to be able to reopen, or if you can reopen but not get more benefits if you haven't shown that change or that effect on earning capacity, if you could see the distinction. I'm not sure under that decision if the effect in earning capacity, well, it's clear under the other cases you still must prove it. Is that something to prove to reopen the case or just to recover additional benefits?
Clear question.
Did the hearing officer objectively look at her condition at the time of settlement before getting to the evidence at the time of the rehearing, or did you overly persuade him to look at what her claims were before and her claims are not changed? They're of total disability.
I guess to answer that, well, I can't speak for exactly what the hearing examiner considered. The evidence was presented in her own handwriting, her own words, primarily based on the Social Security Administration application. That was the primary evidence that, as the employer and insurer, that we presented to document what she believed her condition was, what she was representing, sworn under oath, subject to the penalty of perjury, and that was what he
right, but
primarily
instead
looked
of
at.
What she believed to be her condition, in other words, her claims, did he really look at what her condition was based on all the medical reports that there were at that time?
I believe that he did. I think there is no doubt, based on the department's written decision, that he was probably highly persuaded by her own statements in the Social Security application. But the department was presented with five volumes of medical records as well. And the statements made in the medical records, the opinions of those providers, were all briefed at length to the department, and that's certainly something that I believe the department considered as well, that they did look at medical and vocational and her own testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Hey, Mr. Radke, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Mr. Sabers, I'm not sure that the hearing examiner even addressed at all medical condition or change in medical condition. I think he decided not to. He looked at vocational change and decided that based upon that alone, And that might have been decided based in part upon medical records, I don't know. But it was mainly based upon vocational change that this thing was over.
Is there anything in his findings that indicate that he looked at her condition objectively without being overly persuaded by what her claims were or what her subsequent claims on Social Security were?
If I remember right, well, the findings are drawn up by counsel for respondents and were very heavily dependent upon what they felt were admissions by the claimant as to her physical condition, and I don't believe so, but, you know, who am I to say, you know? I don't know.
You're the best we got, so
fire away. That's a scary proposition, Justice Sabres. No, I don't think they did, but again, I don't think I win or lose this case, and I hate to say this, based upon that, I think, you know, that I get back to that this employability issue was thoroughly addressed in the settlement agreement, and if we throw that out, we're going to have a hodgepodge of decisions out there with respect to do we really or do we really not still consider the agreement to speak for itself.
Okay, it was thoroughly addressed, okay, but what was the conclusion? Assuming for a minute that you're right, that it was, and I kind of agree, that it was thoroughly addressed, but like you've stated before, it's a compromise settlement agreement. It's all over the place. It isn't fixed. It's not unequivocal. Tell me what the condition was if it was ever settled on something.
If it was settled, that she's something less than unemployable, and that she couldn't get more than $32,000 in new disability benefits if she went to hearing. That's as specific as you can get, considering that she, as I tried to introduce evidence of, there was a report from or a calculation made by the Department of Labor, which didn't come in, but I tried to introduce evidence that showed that the amount of benefits she was entitled to were huge compared to what she received in new benefits. It said no.
So you think you determined the condition based on what percent she recovered in relation to what her maximum recovery could have been?
Well, you know, it's a slippery slope, Justice Sabres. I mean, we've looked at, from as far as contributory negligence, is 20% contributory or not? In this case, I think it was so far-fetched that this would be a perm total settlement based upon the amount that, yeah, I think you can. It's not a great way to have to practice law, and it's not a great benchmark, but, yeah, I think you can. And it said she wouldn't get any more hearing. If you can't get any more hearing, how can you be perm total? I mean, there's thousands and thousands of dollars left out there, as evidenced by the fact that we filed a petition asking for perm total. You know, and she didn't get them. It says she wasn't entitled to them. If she went to hearing, she wouldn't get them. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's unambiguous, I think. I was going to point something out. Would this situation be a lot different from the perspective Judge Zinner asked earlier? What's the legislature think of this? What were they thinking at the time? Well, if this situation was similar to, for instance, just to throw something out, this statute, 62733, says it can go either way. The employer can come back and say, person's gotten better. Well, let's just say, for instance, a person was injured, terrible back injury at a factory. They alleged a terrible back injury. The employer investigated it, said, no, malingerer. The investigator looked at it, said, you know, I've seen him climbing around on things. I've seen him doing farm work. Doesn't seem injured to me. His doctor says perm total will never work again. The employer insurer, and this happened, settled the case. And 5 years later, some people reported that this guy was a lot better off than they thought, and they got on top of a grain bin, took pictures, saw he was riding a horse and making the horse buck, and that he was seen doing chores and doing all these things. They want to go reopen. They want to go shut off benefits. It didn't amount to fraud. They tried. It didn't get there. So it was just a change in condition. Now, can you imagine? The employer had argued throughout and is in the agreement that, you know, he'd argued throughout that this thing is, you know, was not going anywhere as a malingerer. He was not entitled to perm total. He had experts. He had investigators. But the fact is, the settlement agreement said perm total disability benefits, $180,000, something like that. He wants to get that money back or stop the payments or stop the meds. And the court would say, or the, you know, the hearing examiner in a case like this would probably say, well, you know, you argued that originally. You can't. You made your point originally. This person was already unemployable, was already employable. You had investigators, you had experts, you claimed that this person, you know, was a malingerer, and yet you paid. So sad, so bad, you lose. You know, if it's shifted to the other side and this guy gets away with murder, even though it's not, we're not talking fraud, we're just talking it'd have to be a reopening petition, would the legislature contemplate that no, we'd hold the employer, who knew what he knew at the time, to, well, you already knew, you should have gone to trial, you should have won, you made a bad deal. I don't think so. I've got 4 minutes and 15 seconds left. I'd like to address one concept. Obviously, you can interject. Okay. There's one point I haven't made that might be the strongest argument in this case. It's fairly complicated, and I'll try to move along. I've got 4 minutes. Now, under South Dakota law, if a claimant asks for benefits, in this case, perm total disability, the insurance company can only turn them down. The insurer, who is a party in this particular case, can only turn them down if there's been a reasonable investigation and they've determined that the claim was not fairly debatable. In this particular case, when I went in 2003 and asked the employer and insurer to admit claim, as they claimed in 2003, was permanently totally disabled in the year 1996 at the time of settlement.
This is your bad faith claim? This is your claim?
No, what it is I'm going to compare it to the Kermode case, and what I think where I'm going with this is I believe that although they don't come out and admit it, that the respondents in this case are trying to escape bad language for them that was inserted into the agreement with respect to employability. And when I asked them to admit, they said we can't admit or deny because we hadn't performed an investigation. We didn't go out and do what they had a job to do under law, which is perform a reasonable investigation. Therefore, we can't say it back in 1996. Now, there was testimony or statement earlier made by counsel for response during oral argument that this is a fairly new case and the parties were doing what they were doing. Well, this wasn't a new case. There's a 1991 or 1992 IME which had taken place already. There's like four IMEs that were out there. This was not in any way, shape, or form a new case. And they had every option to go get some type of vocational assessment and didn't do it. There was none. There was a reason, because it wasn't going to turn out well for them. And so they said they can't admit or deny because they didn't have a vocational assessment. They couldn't make that determination as to what she was in 1996. But in 2003, when it behooves them to say, oh, yeah, she was permanently totally disabled. She said she was, and forget what our experts said, but she was permanently totally disabled. Now, what they want to do is they want to run from the settlement agreement, which said anything but permanent total disability. They want to benefit from not performing the investigation. They had a good faith, I guess to that extent it is a good faith argument. They had a good faith duty to perform, but where I'm going with this is under the Kermody case, that was a case where an insurance company accidentally or mistakenly paid under a contract of insurance they thought they had with the claimant. But it turned out the claimant should have been making the claim against another insurance company. Years later, they came back and wanted to rescind the agreement. And the court says, well, if there's been a reasonable mistake made by paying under a contract when you shouldn't have, then, yeah, as long as there's no bad faith failure to investigate or to figure things out ahead of time, then yes, you can straighten this matter out. In this case, there was, in fact, a bad faith failure to investigate, to determine what they argue wholeheartedly today, the claim was permanently totally disabled. They had a duty to pay benefits for life, every week for the rest of her life. And what they will have been able to accomplish is to get away with shirking the responsibilities imposed by the insurance laws to investigate the claim. And they will get out of paying a permanent total disability claim that they knew existed at the time, while shirking their responsibilities to investigate. And that Kermody case says you've got to do a reasonable investigation. In this case, it's imposed by law before you can argue that you should be let out of the terms of the unambiguous settlement agreement. And the unambiguous settlement agreement says she's less than permanently totally disabled.
Thank you, Mr. Radke.
Thanks.
Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.